The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up.
CBS News Special Report.
It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News with Jeff Glor.
We're going to begin with our interview with the president late this afternoon.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Remembering the man who put country first.
I've spoken of 1,000 points of light, of all the community organizations that are spread like stars throughout the nation doing good.
Later, why folks in Paris are protesting.
And now, from the Capital One Bank Studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this weekend in Texas.
God bless America.
It's where former President George H.W. Bush was laid to rest Thursday, ending 6 days of public mourning. The country paid a final tribute to him there with a fighter jet flyover and missing man formation. Mr. Bush died Friday at age 94. He's buried at his presidential library at Texas A&M next to his wife Barbara and their daughter Robin, who died from leukemia at age 3 in 1953. Let's talk now with CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman in Houston. Steve, let's start with how Texas has responded to his death. He was not native to the state, but he might as well have been.
Yeah, he's been here since the 1940s. This was his adopted state and Houston, his adopted home. He called Houston home, and he was really well known in the Houston area. He took part in everyday activities. He would go to local restaurants. He would go to Astros games a lot. So many people here had at least a brief interaction with him. They liked him very much, whether they were Democrat or Republican. Enough time had passed when he was a political candidate that he seemed to be liked by everyone. And it really was an outpouring of grief here throughout the week. I think people were a bit surprised. There had been no advance word that he was failing, that he was about to die, death was imminent. So I think it caught people here by surprise. And wherever you went, you would talk to people. They would want to talk to you if they knew you were a reporter about Bush, maybe interactions they had. This was a very sincere, genuine reaction here, not just in Houston, but throughout the entire state.
And we saw folks lining that railroad route from that depot north of Houston all the way down to College Station, paying their final tributes.
It was beautiful, and we got to see the casket through the clear glass that he's in, and some of the people on the train waved at us.
To me, that's going to be the lasting memory of all these days, this week-long tribute to George Herbert Walker Bush. When you have these people lining the train route from small town after small town, that's what made it, I think, even more special. This was a genuine reaction.
I thought it was an amazing experience. I've never seen anything like this before.
Schools let their students out to go see the train go by. Businesses shut down. Police forces, the entire police force in some small towns would show up, stand near the rail. They would stand in line at attention, salute. People waved American flags. There were signs, and also something you wouldn't necessarily think, but it does make sense. They would cheer as the train went by. They weren't cheering that he had died. They were cheering the life he led.
Going back to that National Cathedral funeral service, there were some poignant moments, including one from his son, former President George W.
Well, that's something we have never seen before, probably will never see again. A former president delivering a eulogy for another former president who happens to be his father. And George W. Bush held up strongly. You could see the emotion on his face, but at the very end, when he was giving the final tribute to his father, he did break down, and it was quite moving.
Through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man, the best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again.
President Trump was also at that funeral service, and there were some uncomfortable moments.
Awkward would be the best word to describe it. He did show up. He sat with three other living presidents and first ladies, Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, Bill and Hillary Clinton, Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter. There wasn't much interaction. When he arrived, he briefly shook the hands of Barack Obama, Michelle Obama. We tried to read their words. I think they both said good morning. That was pretty much it. After that, there seemed to be little, if any, interaction amongst that group, and it did seem a bit uncomfortable for all of them there.
And finally, at the Capitol, Steve, tributes to him while he was lying in state in the rotunda.
Well, there were many moving tributes. Some of his former associates showed up. I was very moved when Colin Powell, who was one of the architects, along with George Herbert Walker Bush of the first Gulf War, he showed up. And then one of the most moving moments was when Bob Dole, a longtime friend of President Bush, also in his 90s, confined to a wheelchair. He had to be helped up. He had to be helped to use his hand to salute. Of course, he only has one hand he can use. He saluted his former chief executive, his former commander-in-chief, sat down. That was also very moving.
CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman on the life and death of George Herbert Walker Bush. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
One of his biggest legacies may have been his call to service, his 1,000 points of light.
I will keep America moving forward, always forward, for an endless, enduring dream and 1,000 points of light. This is my mission, and I will complete it.
And correspondent Mark Strassman introduces us to one woman shining bright.
But this is the corner that means the world to you.
Yeah.
Annie Moore's reclaiming the street corner at the intersection of blight and despair.
What happens in that corner?
Drug deals, prostitution, gambling, everything.
This is Atlanta's English Avenue neighborhood, Moore's neighborhood.
I have a problem with seeing your business on the street.
What they do is their business. How they do it is your business.
Yes. Because you have to have respect for your neighbors.
Moore went to work.
The first thing I did was build chess tables.
These chess tables?
Yes.
Putting out the tables was symbolic.
Yeah, I care. We care. Somebody cares.
We just cleaned it out.
She brought truckloads of donated dirt into this abandoned church.
There's no place in English Avenue for people to gather, and we were trying to make this the gathering spot.
What do you see this space becoming?
Open air market. Come on, guys.
This 57-year-old grandmother personifies President Bush's points of light.
Did you think you had it in you?
I didn't know. I just started doing it. This is what this will look like. I don't want to build another neighborhood like English Avenue somewhere else in Atlanta. I want to fix what's going on here.
Point of light honoree.
Mm-hmm. See, George Bush.
This past January 15th, Moore was named a daily point of light, number 6175 since President Bush launched the program in 1990.
He's allowed a whole lot of us to go down in history with him. Like, we're a part of him.
They have shared history, lights that led the way. Mark Strassman, CBS News, Atlanta.
And we'll continue to remember Mr. Bush throughout the broadcast. Coming up, developments in the Russia probe. That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
President George H.W. Bush left his mark on the globe, not just the U.S. Before being elected president, he served at the U.N. as U.S. ambassador and also ambassador to China. Let's talk with CBS News analyst Pam Falk at the United Nations. Pam, what legacy did he leave behind in foreign policy?
As ambassador to the UN from 1971 to 1973, Mr. Bush cut his teeth in global diplomacy during a period when the U.S. remained mired in Vietnam and the Cold War began to enter a new phase.
He was also an advocate for modern China when he was ambassador to that country, right?
What became known as the Two China Solution, he, as U.S. ambassador under the Nixon administration, pushed for Mao Zedong's government to be admitted to the U.N. while letting the Republic of China, or Taiwan, also retain its seat. Now, although the General Assembly voted to reject that proposal, in the years that followed, China relations improved.
One other topic this weekend, Pam, is the announcement on Friday by President Trump of Heather Nauert to fill the role Nikki Haley is leaving as U.S. ambassador to the U.N. She has a background at Fox News. She's most recently been the spokesperson for the State Department, but she doesn't have political or policy-making experience. How many challenges does Nauert face?
Steve, she faces many challenges, and Ambassador Nikki Haley's boots are big to fill. The UN has had several female ambassadors from the U.S., but the post is not always cabinet-level position, and that is why Ambassador Haley spoke with the authority of the president, and diplomats perceived that, especially since she brought the Security Council to the White House, and she traveled to Africa and Latin America and made some strides in the way the U.S. deals with the Middle East. Now, Heather Nauert will have to be the top multilateral negotiator at a time when the very powerful 15-member Security Council is stymied on the world's biggest crises, Syria, North Korea, nuclear weapons, most recently the crisis in Yemen. And so she is going to have to learn a lot pretty fast.
CBS News Foreign Affairs Analyst Pam Falk at the United Nations on the Weekend Roundup. Thanks, Pam.
Absolutely, Steve. Good to be here.
It was a wild week for the stock market amid fears trade talks with China could derail. The good news: continued low unemployment numbers, according to federal data released Friday. Here's CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger.
The actual economy bottomed out in June of 2009. So here we are in 2018, and we are seeing job creation averaging 206,000 a month. That is very strong relative to being this long into a recovery.
More Paris protests this weekend, first triggered by an increase in a fuel tax that the government has since backed off of. More from CBS News correspondent Elaine Cobb in Paris.
There will be protests around the country too, and police in a Paris suburb have been criticized for the way they arrested 150 rioting teenagers who were pictured on their knees with their hands tied behind their backs. Elaine Cobb, CBS News, Paris.
A new study shows global emissions of carbon dioxide have reached a record high. Countries are releasing more greenhouse gases than ever before.
Scientists say more than 37 billion tons of planet-warming emissions have been released into the atmosphere this year.
Almost all countries are contributing to this around the world.
The stark findings come as leaders from nearly 200 nations meet in Poland to decide how to meet the goals of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, aimed at stopping flooding, heat waves, and rising sea levels.
We're seeing climate change unfolding. We're seeing actually predictions that have been made some decades ago turning into reality.
China produces 27% of the world's global emissions, which are expected to rise 4.7% this year. The U.S. is the world's second worst polluter, accounting for 15% of global emissions. The European Union and India round out the top four. Experts say a booming global market for cars has helped drive CO2 emissions to an all-time high, and that renewed coal use is adding to the problem. Climate campaigners say the emissions trend can still be turned around by 2020, but only if substantial cuts are made. Tina Kraus, CBS News.
Meanwhile, back in the U.S., the EPA is moving forward with plans to roll back Obama-era rules targeting coal power plant emissions. Bipartisan condemnation of Saudi Arabia following a briefing by CIA Director Gina Haspel on Capitol Hill for some senators on the murder of Saudi dissident and Washington Post opinion writer Jamal Khashoggi.
Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican of South Carolina, didn't hold back.
I went into the briefing believing it was virtually impossible for an operation like this to be carried out without the Crown Prince's knowledge. I left the briefing with high confidence that my initial assessment of the situation is correct.
A view shared by Senate Foreign Relations Chair Bob Corker, who said it was clear the Crown Prince orchestrated Khashoggi's death. Bill Rakoff, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
New developments in the Russia probe.
Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn may be avoiding jail time, even though he has admitted to lying to the FBI. In court papers released Tuesday night, special counsel Robert Mueller suggested Mr. Flynn avoid jail because of the substantial assistance he gave during Mueller's investigation of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia.
Lock her up. That's right.
Flynn was an early supporter of President Trump and became part of his inner circle during the 2016 presidential election. Shortly after the election, it was revealed that he had been communicating with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Flynn admitted to the lies last December and began providing Mueller with information. In all, prosecutors say General Flynn gave 19 separate interviews to investigators and provided documents and communications concerning the links between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. The special counsel also noted that Flynn's decision to flip prompted others in the president's circle to cooperate as well. Mueller's court filing was heavily redacted because much of what Mr. Flynn told him is still being used in active investigations. Five people who were in senior positions in the Trump campaign or the president's inner circle have agreed to provide evidence to the special counsel on the Russia probe. Kenneth Craig, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
Also Friday, prosecutors revealed in a new court filing that former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen deserves substantial prison time despite his cooperation with special counsel investigators. Meanwhile, President Trump says he'll nominate former Attorney General William Barr, who served in the first Bush administration, to the post again.
During his tenure, he demonstrated an unwavering adherence to the rule of law.
And the president announcing another staffing change Saturday at the White House, with Chief of Staff John Kelly exiting the administration at the end of the year.
John Kelly will be leaving, but I don't know if I can say retiring, but he's a great guy.
Up next, life in the Bush 41 White House press office.
He remained always and consistently compassionate and caring.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio presents the Intelligence Matters podcast, taking you inside the biggest stories in national security.
How concerned are you?
I'm concerned that the Russians never left.
Each week, former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, interviews top leaders from the U.S. intelligence community.
James Clapper, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, Mike Hayden.
And lucky for you, you won't need a security clearance to listen. The Intelligence Matters podcast. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
We're continuing our tributes this weekend to former President George H.W. Bush. One of those inspired by Mr. Bush, Kristen Clark Taylor, who wrote about her experience working in his White House press office for the Washington Post. Kristen, I want to start with a memorable moment you had when you introduced your young son back in 1987 to then the Vice President George H.W. Bush. What was that?
He was about 2 years old. We were at the Vice President's residence for a picnic. And Bush walked over to him and said, "Who have we here?" And he leaned down and he shook my son's hand and he picked him up, put him on his shoulders, gave him a fun horsey ride. Well, my son had had what you have at a picnic. He'd had a couple of bites of a hot dog and a couple of sips of some fruit punch and a bunch of other junk food. And he'd not had that before. He vomited all over the vice president's head, his face, and the front of his shirt.
How do you take it?
You know what? He was, and I hate to use a past tense. He was a consummate family man. So he was cool about it. He just kind of took my son off of his shoulders and said, jovially, he just said, "Well, I think that'll be the last time I ever hold your son, Kristen." He walked into the house and changed his clothes and came on back out. That's the kind of man he was.
Can you describe what it was like later when he was president to work for him in his press office?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the beauty of it is, and I worked for him, I had the privilege to work for him when he was vice president and president, and I'm often asked, did he change or was there any kind of a shift in his personality or his demeanor during that transition? And I'm always happy and always proud and always mindful of the fact that he didn't. He remained always and consistently compassionate and caring. I like to say that he was a mindful man. Long before mindfulness became a buzzword, he would create within the way he thought, he'd create a pause. And in that pause was power. The power of the pause is something I talk about a lot, and it gave him the ability to contemplate and to reflect. It didn't mean that he didn't make swift and sure decisions. It just meant that he wanted to stop himself and be right in that moment and make an informed decision. That's what I really loved about him.
As you know, every president has his own signature on American history. What do you think President Bush's is?
I think so many things. I think that the legacy that, and I don't even like to use the word leave, because leave is such an inactive word. He didn't just leave a legacy. He created one. And there is action in the word creation. What he left for us is, if we treat it with respect and with dignity, the values that he left won't leave with him. He created something and pushed along such positive energy into the world. And we, as stewards of that energy, should, you know, and will continue to move forward in the world in the same way he did, with dignity and with grace and with love.
He's been described, as you've noted, for his steady-handed leadership.
Mm-hmm.
He isn't described as a radical by any measure, including his allies and those in his own party. Do you think, though, he was a change maker at all? Because some criticize his leadership on things like combating AIDS, on race relations. Do you think he had a positive effect on moving the nation forward?
Oh, sure, yes. I think he had a positive, consistently positive momentum that he created. And I don't think, I reject the claim that that momentum ever waned, because I never saw it wane. I think his being a diplomat and a global leader helped him take decisive action early, but not too early. He was never premature in his decisions, that he forcibly, and the military, the forced military removal, for instance, of Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega, he didn't hesitate on that. The invasion of Kuwait, he did not hesitate on that. And so those are the kinds of things that show not only his decisiveness, because I don't think necessarily being a decision maker is the mark of a leader, but being decisive and compassionate and moving from a place of knowledge. And that's what he did.
How different of a place is Washington today than when it was when you were serving in the White House? And do you think we'll ever get back to that point?
I think there is, and I'm going to just take a moment and sound kind of real pie in the sky-ish here, which is unusual in D.C., but what I believe is that love prevails. And what I believe is that decency and a commonality between all of us prevails. It has to. There is no other option. And I think that what George Bush left for us was a notion that all of us together can really push that kind of positive momentum forward, because it will move forward. Even though he's gone, the momentum that he created will not wane.
Former Bush press aide Kristen Clark Taylor on his legacy and hope and optimism in Washington and at the White House. Thanks.
Thank you.
The future is here, at least in a Tesla.
Authorities in California say when the driver of a Tesla failed to stop for police lights and sirens, they used the car's autopilot system to stop it. The California Highway Patrol says the car was doing about 70 miles an hour, and they saw the driver was asleep. Officers pulled in front of the vehicle, and the driver assist program forced the car to stop. The driver was arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas at the beach at the Vatican.
For the first time, the nativity scene is made of sand, 720 tons that were brought in from northern Italy. Rich Verano was the head sculptor.
It's a wonderful medium to work with because of the immediacy. To make a sculpture of this size in any other material would take a lot longer.
The professional sand artist from Florida says he was honored to work in a place so filled with history, art, and culture. Sabina Castelfranco, CBS News, Vatican City.
Coming up on the weekend roundup, new details in the investigation into former CBS head Les Moonves.
Among the new allegations in the report, Moonves had a CBS employee on call to perform oral sex on him.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Now to news closer to home here at CBS, the investigation into former CEO Les Moonves. A new report by investigators obtained by the New York Times says Moonves tried to cover up his alleged sexual misconduct at CBS.
According to the Times, the 59-page draft report says Moonves deliberately lied about and minimized the extent of his sexual misconduct, partly to protect his $120 million severance package. Plus, he allegedly deleted text messages, instructed at least one person not to speak to investigators, and that either he or someone else handed over his son's iPad to investigators instead of his own. According to the Times, investigators interviewed 11 women and found their accounts to be credible. The Times says the lawyers have now identified a total of 17 women. Among the new allegations in the report, Moonves had a CBS employee on call to perform oral sex on him and received oral sex from at least four CBS employees under circumstances that sound transactional. The Times also reports that investigators found at least one CBS board member knew of the sexual misconduct allegations about Moonves before joining the board in 2007, and that last year, CBS's former head of communications learned of a sexual misconduct allegation against Moonves, but did not report it. Moonves' attorney did tell the Times, though, that he denies having any non-consensual sexual relation and cooperated extensively and fully with investigators. A spokesman for the investigators said no findings have been reported to the board, and the board has reached no conclusions on this matter.
Correspondent Tarika Duncan reporting. Now to another powerful man who was accused of sexual misconduct and brought down, Roger Ailes, who led Fox News.
I had a see-through desk. He said, if you want to play with the big boys, you have to lay with the big boys.
There have been plenty of settlements that none of us know about.
That's from the film Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes that premiered this weekend. Alexis Bloom directed that documentary. You know, it's clear from the film that Ailes saw himself as a puppet master of politicians like Richard Nixon, but also of many careers in TV and behind the camera. What do you think he was chasing?
I don't know what he was chasing. He was certainly ambitious. He wanted to have an influence in our cultural landscape. He wanted to kind of counter what he said with kind of the New York and the, you know, the Los Angeles elites. He was kind of motivated by a feeling of being an outsider and a little bit of vengeance, I would say. And he wanted to make a big, you know, political impact. He sort of described himself as a patriot, and he wanted to bring America back to its kind of, you know, patriotic virtues, you know, in some ways kind of echoing what Trump says about make America great again. You know, he kind of wanted to make America great, and he wanted to carve his space in the political and cultural landscape. And he did that through Fox News, I'd say.
So you think he was effective?
I do. I think Fox News, which was his creation, I mean, Rupert Murdoch was the money behind Fox News, but he was the, you know, the vision and the creative force, and he built this company up from literally nothing. It started in 1996, you know, it's not that long ago, into a big, you know, billion-dollar, you know, money-making machine that is kind of, you know, highly, highly watched, and watched by very sort of key groups of people in terms of, you know, the country and the elections and everything, and it's, you know, its numbers are huge. So, yeah, he was successful. I mean, whether you like him or not, you know, he set out to do what he wanted to do, and he, you know, he made a lot of money, and he, you know, created a company that far, you know, that outlives him.
The film links so much of Ailes to the story of Fox News. Do you think that network is still the same without him, or has as much relevance?
I mean, the network isn't the same without him. But it's, you know, it's staffed by people who were groomed by him. You know, the head now is Suzanne Scott, who, you know, cut her teeth in Ailes' time, you know, and was a loyal lieutenant to Ailes. you know, some of the key people are still there in the legal counsel, in, you know, marketing and PR. You know, a few people have left, but a lot of the people who were there were Ailes' protégés. So it hasn't changed dramatically. It has become, I think, much more explicit in its kind of support of the administration. The current, you know, it's sort of like people have called it state TV or kind of a sort of propaganda. But it was always kind of a revolving door with the GOP. You know, people were, you know, in politics and then were pundits on Fox and then back into politics. And, you know, that has always been the case. I don't know whether it would have been a different place were Ailes to be, you know, alive. He, you know, his big thing was don't lose the audience. You know, whatever you do, do not lose your audience. And, I mean, Fox has not lost its audience. So they've been successful in that.
Before he died back in 2017 and was a victim of the Me Too era, do you think that was the only thing then that could have brought him down?
You know, I don't know. You know, when Gretchen Carlson filed her suit, there wasn't the Me Too movement. It seems crazy, but he was one of the first. You know, so we weren't at all sure that it was going to bring him down. You know, could have quite easily have not. And I think that the Murdochs were waiting for an opportunity. The boys, Lachlan and James, were, you know, waiting for the right time to take him out, you know, and he was taken out. You know, so I think it was, you know, opportunity presented itself, but they had been longing to do this. You know, there was no love lost between the Murdoch boys and Roger Ailes, and this provided them with a good opportunity.
Director and producer Alexis Bloom on Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes. Thanks, Alexis.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Now back to George H.W. Bush and man's best friend.
The plane carrying the casket from Texas to the nation's capital also transported his beloved companion, Sully, a yellow Labrador Retriever service dog who was photographed sleeping in front of the former president's casket in a picture that went viral. A family spokesman who shared the photo wrote the caption, "Mission complete." Sully had accompanied the president in the final months of his life. Sully was trained by America's Vet Dogs. He will soon begin a new role of helping wounded veterans at Walter Reed National Medical Center.
Correspondent Cammie McCormick reporting. A British teen finds prison is no hoax.
A British 19-year-old who sent hoax bomb threats to more than 1,700 U.S. and British schools has been jailed for 3 years in a case the FBI helped to break. Operating from his bedroom north of London, George Du Cohan also triggered a United Airlines hijack scare. He phoned San Francisco Airport posing as a concerned father.
I'm really getting frustrated here. My daughter just called me like 10 minutes ago, crying on the phone saying that her flight was getting hijacked.
Du Cohan was said to have been inspired by the Columbine High School massacre. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
Coming up, the state of hunger in the U.S.
Overall, about 40 million Americans are food insecure.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
What we want to try to do is give the American people the truth.
Trump cabinet member Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
He has keys to the universe.
Actually, it's a key fob.
Right. You have a fob to the universe. Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Thinking about a holiday break this month? From celebrities' infinite verandas to new activities on and offboard cruise ships, more Americans are setting sail.
This isn't your grandparents' cruise ship. With the flick of a switch, you see one way the new Celebrity Edge cruise ship is different. Many rooms come with floor-to-ceiling windows that open halfway, and there's more space inside.
These rooms bring the outside in or the inside out, however you want to look at it.
There's also a French bistro with projected animation that turns your table into entertainment. Okay. And you'll find new technology on the outside of the ship.
This is what Celebrity calls the magic carpet. It's a movable platform on the side of the ship that takes guests to the edge.
It can transform from a restaurant to a launching dock for excursions, depending on where it's positioned. This is the first newly designed ship from Celebrity in 10 years, but it has plenty of competition. Upscale Seabourn Cruise Line launched Ovation in May, Carnival's Horizon debuted in April, and the world's largest cruise ship, Royal Caribbean's Symphony of the Seas, arrived at its new Miami terminal last month.
Different people want different experiences. They want different activities.
And the number of cruise ship passengers has gone from nearly 18 million in 2009 to a projected 30 million next year. That's driving demand for more ships, and more are on the way, including three from the new adults-only Virgin Voyages cruise line.
We have 111 ships on order right now, which is between now and 2027.
And with only about 3% of Americans currently cruising every year, industry insiders see potential for bookings to swell as more people discover life on the high seas. Wendy Gillette, CBS News, Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
A little holiday help from Tyler Perry.
Medea is paying it forward.
I hope y'all can appreciate what I'm going to try to do.
The man behind the movie character, Tyler Perry, has announced a surprise for customers at two Walmart stores near Atlanta.
I have paid for all of your layaways for Christmas.
Total amount, $434,000.
God bless you. Go get your stuff. Merry Christmas.
Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
A new report shows just how much this country is still struggling with hunger. Joel Berg is head of Hunger Free America. Joel, what have you found?
Overall, about 40 million Americans, including many children, senior citizens, and people with disabilities, are food insecure.
How much of a trend is this following over the last few years?
Well, hunger and food insecurity have gone down marginally in America over the last 6 years as the economy's improved, but the number of people struggling to feed their families is still far higher than before the recession and much higher than during the height of the Clinton-era economic boom. So we're sort of told to accept as some sort of new normal that 40 million Americans can't afford enough food, and we as advocates fundamentally reject that as acceptable.
On a state-by-state level, what have you found?
We found that the states with the highest levels of poverty, no shock, had the highest levels of hunger. So when it comes to working hungry people, New Mexico, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama have the highest rates of hunger among working poor people. Many of the states also have the highest levels of child hunger. So it's no shock when states have lower wages, when they have higher poverty, when they don't have an adequate minimum wage, there's more hunger, particularly among working people.
What's working in the world of fighting hunger and what isn't working?
Well, we know exactly what works because in the 1970s, we had a plan to dramatically increase the nutrition safety net and make sure that the economy was more inclusive. Part of that was spurred on, actually, by a pioneering CBS TV documentary on hunger in America that spurred people like Richard Nixon and Bob Dole, normally pretty conservative Republicans, to join with Democrats like George McGovern and Jimmy Carter to create the modern nutrition assistance safety net. So increasing wages, reducing unemployment, and increasing a food safety net all work together to decrease hunger. And so we almost ended hunger entirely in the 1970s, and we know what doesn't work is pretending that we replace those efforts with uncoordinated, underfunded charity, with the thousand points of light, or with the faith-based armies of compassion. And we know that when we undo efforts to ensure higher wages, when we undo safety net programs, no amount of charity in America can pick up the slack.
Hunger Free America CEO Joel Berg on the state of hunger in the U.S. Thank you, Joel.
Thank you.
On Friday morning, the man announced to host the Oscars had bailed out.
I'm Tom Foti. A controversial comedian will not be the heart and soul of the next Oscar award ceremony. Kevin Hart tweeting overnight he does not want to be a distraction, so he's pulling out of the hosting gig announced just 2 days before. That became controversial with the discovery of old tweets that some considered homophobic. Hart did address them on social media before his final decision.
I've spoken on it. I've said where the rights and wrongs were. I've said who I am now versus who I was then. I've done it.
And Hart is now apologizing. Tom Foti, CBS News.
Finally this weekend, let's pay a final tribute to President George H.W. Bush with impersonation, of course, the highest form of flattery.
The way to do the president is to start out with Mr. Rogers. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Then you add a little John Wayne. Here we go. Let's go over the ridge. You put them together. You got George Herbert Walker Bush.
Together, President Bush and his comedic foil, Dana Carvey, forged a perhaps unexpected friendship, one that started after Bush lost his bid for re-election in 1992. Mr. Bush invited Carvey to the White House as a pick-me-up for the staff.
I was staying in the Lincoln bedroom last night, and I couldn't resist getting on the phone, and I called up the Secret Service as the president. Feel like going jogging tonight. In the nude.
Carvey's Saturday Night Live impressions were comedy gold.
Bad, they're bad.
So memorable, Mr. Bush himself had to join in the fun.
Not gonna do it. Not gonna do it.
In all my years of government service, I never once said, Nagada.
The president's grace and generosity vividly on display as he recounted a phone call to Carvey.
He said, I hope I've never crossed the line. And I knew exactly what he meant. And as far as I'm concerned, he never has. And the fact that we can laugh at each other is a very fundamental thing.
We had so many warm moments with them. And
in April, Carvey described his 25-year friendship with the Bushes and how times have coarsened.
They didn't demonize the other side, you know, it was just a different time.
Upon Mr. Bush's death, Carvey wrote simply, when I think of those times, what I remember most is how hard we would laugh. I will miss my friend. Major Garrett, CBS News, Washington.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.